BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Tom Heap, and this is Costing the Earth from BBC Radio 4. I'm walking on a footpath in the south of England. About 5 miles in front of me, I can see the English Channel, and between me and the water are rolling hills occasionally flanked by copses and stretches of woodland. Because I'm in the South Downs, more specifically the South Downs National Park, the newest national park, designated because of its wildlife, its cultural heritage, and the beauty of its countryside. But like so many of our national parks, this is a landscape under pressure. Nigel James is the Countryside and Policy Manager with the South Downs National Park Authority.
The South Downs National Park has two purposes: to conserve and enhance, and then promote enjoyment and understanding. The key issues for the national park in this quite crowded part of southern England are perception. People think it's owned by the National Park Authority when all the land is privately owned. Population: within 5 kilometres of the national park, you know, we have 2 million people approximately. And then working with our landowners to resolve the pressures that population brings.
National parks enjoy widespread public support, and they're important to me. One of the first ones I remember enjoying was the Peak District National Park. As a teenager and in my 20s, I used to go rock climbing around Stanage Edge and Froggatt Edge. Next year will be the 70th anniversary of the Act of Parliament, which designated many of these places as national parks. A lot has changed since then, and our national parks face increasing challenges. There's loss of wildlife, unaffordable housing, poor public access in some places, and also the challenge to farming here that might come as a result of Brexit. So in this week's Costing the Earth, I'm off to two very different national parks to hear how they might be able to work better, not just for people, but also for wildlife. But first, I had a chat with writer and journalist Julian Glover, who's leading a government review into protected landscapes in England. He's been asked by Environment Secretary Michael Gove to look afresh at how these landscapes might be improved for the next generation.
The purpose of national parks was to protect some of the most precious, most beautiful, most loved bits of the English, the British landscape. And it came out of a really inspirational thing, which was after the First World War. There was much talk of a land fit for heroes, a nation which was more equal. People had more access to health and recreation. They weren't trapped in the cities, in the slums. And there was a campaign to try and open up some of the landscape, protect it and give access to people. And it produced all sorts of things. It led to the welfare state, to the NHS. But it also, and we don't always remember it now, led to some visionary protection for landscape. And it was done with national ambition. So there were two great reports, the Hobhouse Report and the Dower Report, which led to legislation in 1949, 70 years ago next year, which led to our national parks, our landscape protection, to some of the national trails, things like the Pennine Way and the Southwest Coast Path. All of them had their origins in this inspiring moment after the Second World War.
And what are their key statutory purposes?
National parks have a core purpose of protecting beauty and helping wildlife and providing access. So it's about people as well as about places. And that makes it different from a lot of scientific environmental planning. It's not just about protecting special species, or it's about making these places live for the people of the country.
Why is there a review going on now? I suppose, you know, where is it thought that national parks might be falling short and need improvement?
I've worked in government doing different things, and often I've seen it on the inside. Governments commission reviews when things are going really wrong, and you know, ministers are going on programmes like this, and they don't want to talk about the issue, so they'll say, I've commissioned an independent review to look into the issue and produce recommendations. This one is different. This is a review into something that is a success, but that success in itself produces some pressures. So there's pressures on visitor numbers, pressures on housing, pressures on development, pressures on whether the parks can explain themselves today in the way they did 50, 60 years ago to a new generation of people. And pressures, too, on the environment, on biodiversity and wildlife. And, of course, there's huge controversy. There's all sorts of views on that issue. There's some people who would say they're absolutely failing. They're not succeeding at all. There are others who can point to some completely wonderful things that are going on in the national parks. And But they are changing. We've lost a lot of species. We've seen a decline, just as we have across the UK. So it may not be a fault only of the national parks. But we've seen
it shouldn't
a,
be the national parks be setting an example there. Isn't that the point? That they should be having increasing species, not just mimicking the decline of the rest of the country.
Absolutely. I think the aim of environmental policy and the aim of farming policy, which the government, of course, is looking at as Brexit comes upon us, how do we put money into the countryside in the future to produce what are called public goods? That's a bit of an abstract phrase, but it can mean things like a more living environment, better access for people. Yes, I think national parks can be at the forefront of doing that. They need to have the tools to do it. They need to have the money to do it. It's no good just haranguing them and saying you're not doing a good job. And expecting them to change in themselves. But no, there is opportunity there, and I hope that's part of what the review can propose.
One of the most depressing facts about the natural world of Britain is that more than 50% of our species are in decline and have been for the last 40 years or so. And sadly, the national parks, yes, there are one or two bright spots, but overall, they're not really bucking that trend. But the place I'm in now is really doing its bit to try and push back in the other direction. I'm in the Cairngorms National Park in the heart of Scotland, Britain's biggest national park, and specifically in the Glen Fechey Estate. Trees are regrowing. It suddenly feels like somewhere you've seen from pictures of Canada or the US or Norway. It feels very different from the rest of Britain because this is run by something called Cairngorms Connect, which overall is a 600 square kilometre habitat restoration project where they're trying to link bits of Caledonian pine and other landscapes, and it's the biggest natural restoration project in the UK. Well, two of the managing partners are here with me on this blustery day. That's Chris Donald, Operations Manager at Scottish Natural Heritage, and Thomas McDonnell, the Director of Conservation and Forestry for Wildland Limited, who are actually the biggest private landowner in Britain.
Well, I think as we look around here, you can see the exciting product of what can be achieved through ecological restoration on a landscape scale. This part of Glen Fechey, which has been in about 15 years of very sympathetic management in terms of deer, to provide this wonderful landscape of tree regeneration and ecological complexity. This is what we want to achieve right across the Cairngorms Connect area.
And what was it like before?
In 2000, there was 40 deer per square kilometre here. That would be like a field with sheep in it. All the grass had been, and the heather had been eaten down to a very low level. And there was no tree regeneration whatsoever. All that was visible was the old trees in amongst a heavily grazed sward.
So the deer were just hammering any trees that tried to grow.
It's important not to try and portray the deer as the enemy here. The deer were in some ways the victim of land management practices. But the deer were allowed to get into large densities by man, and therefore the habitat that they needed to survive was being eroded. Not really so much that there was too many deer, it's that there wasn't enough habitat. So what we're trying to do in our exciting initiative, Cairngorms Connect, is to readdress that balance between herbivores and the habitat that the herbivores need to survive.
Deer may not technically have been the enemy, but a lot have been culled.
Yeah, all the partners have been involved with quite heavy culls in a traditional sense, but in terms of ecological restoration, it was necessary to get that ecological bloom coming through.
And ultimately, the goal is that those deer in the future will be living in a much better environment. They'll be much better condition.
Is this rewilding?
It's certainly making it wilder. I think it got hijacked slightly in the UK. The rewilding means anti-sheep farmers. It means wolves and lynx coming in straight away. So we have stayed away from that kind of idea. It seems to be a bit divisive.
Do you think this is rewilding?
I think that it could be classified as rewilding, but we're trying to keep out of that politically charged discussion that's going on. We're the land managers. We've just got to crack on with providing space for the existing species. But at the moment, it's not on our agenda. The main driver of what we're trying to do here is ecological restoration, but also connecting people in nature, getting people involved with what we're doing here. We don't want to be exclusive.
What is the role of private landowners in this whole picture?
The most important thing to remember is that you need a willing landowner. This cannot happen just with government pressure. So it's very important. Pretty much the Cairngorms Connect, we're just the alliance of the willing, really.
How relevant or important to this work is it that this is within the national park?
it is relevant, and we're working together with the authority to make this more significant. They're helping us in terms of promotion and making it relevant to the local people.
What do you think this place will look like, say, in a couple of hundred years?
I think, hopefully, the trees will move up to where we can look at the snow up there, round about 2,500 feet. The pines should be up to that level, not everywhere, but in the quarries, and we'll have woodland right up to the top of the hills.
National parks aren't just about providing a great home for wildlife. They're supposed to be a thriving habitat for people as well. I'm outside the village of Tomintow, which until recently was very much a society in decline, with shops and hotels closing. This is, of course, within the Cairngorm National Park. This bike trail, amongst a bunch of other things, is part of the solution to that problem. Waiting for me at the bottom, assuming I make it in one piece, is Simon Ovenden, who's countryside manager for the Glenlivet Estate.
The bike track was installed about 5 years ago, really to bring added value to the estate. For Crown Estate Scotland, we have an obligation to support the financial elements of people who are living on the estate. In some ways, Tomintow was a declining community. There were certain elements of it, of the tourism, that we weren't tapping into it enough. So that's why we thought, OK, let's put something into the community that's really going to bring more people into the area, which is going to increase the economy.
And is it delivering in terms of those goals, numbers of people staying a while and spending a bit of money?
Certainly it is working. We can't put it all down to the bike trails, which we'd love to, of course.
But an important component.
It's an important component. Rural communities can't exist just on individual elements on their own. There's got to be very much a collective partnership idea that's pulling all these ideas together. And at the moment there's the Tomintow and Glenlivet Landscape Partnership, and this is a group of numerous organisations. It's an HLF funded project, almost £3 million.
And there's a lottery fund, yeah.
Yeah. And there are 20 projects that are taking place across the whole area at the moment. But we're all working together within the national park here to really drive things forward.
Why is it so important to get the community going here, you know, and to keep it healthy?
The communities have been hemorrhaging young people. But with new people coming into the area, they're breathing new life and new vibrancy into the community. So all three of the hotels have now reopened. We've got the fantastic shop in the village, the Whiskey Castle, which is hugely popular. So there is a resurgence of communities.
So very traditional. And all the Tomintows are known as the Gentle Dram.
That is nice. Mm. You know, I think I get even more for it before 11 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Whiskey for breakfast.
Well, I'm not just here for the fun of tasting whiskey. I'm in the village of Tomintow, and I'm with Scott and Samantha Ashforth, who run this place. And tell me a little bit about, you know, why you came. Was it because you could see that this village was in the process of being reborn?
Yes, there were lots and lots of differences going on at the time. When we came up to view the property, there were businesses that were being sold, so we could see it evolving and changing and young families coming in.
That's, and you're part of that change.
Exactly, which is hugely important.
We've certainly seen a big increase in the way that people operate their businesses. There seems to be this fresh blood that have come in. That's made a big difference. And we have various projects that are ongoing with a huge influx of money. And they're developing a lot of the sites, the castles. So there's a lot of people here that love the area that and want to see it develop. So it's all about the people.
As well as conserving the landscape, a core purpose of national parks is to promote opportunities for the public to visit and enjoy them. And that means making them accessible to people without cars and to groups in society that rarely visit. The charity Campaign for National Parks is calling for new measures to improve sustainable transport and encourage visitors to ditch their vehicles. Ruth Bradshaw is their policy and research manager.
There's a very high reliance on the car. It's approximately 93% on average of people arrive by car. And we're very concerned that that means national parks aren't really doing what they were intended to do in terms of providing a place for everyone, because people that don't have access to a car are really excluded from visiting at the moment. And nationally, it's about 25% of households that don't have access to a car. And over the past few years, with lots of cuts to local authority funding, meaning there's been lots of cuts to rural bus services, then it's become harder and harder for people who don't have a car to visit the national parks.
how do you increase public transport use? Because the basic geography of this isn't really in public transport's favour, is it? Because people are coming from disparate places and going to disparate places, and the car is kind of rather ideal for that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge, and we recognise there are always going to be some people that will want to travel, make their journey to the national park in the first place by car. But what we'd like to see is a lot more focus on having places within the national parks where you could perhaps arrive by car, but also ideally places that were easy to get to without a car as well. But once you were there, you would leave your car behind, and there would be good options for being able to get around to other nearby places and activities. Really sort of focusing on perhaps having some key hubs within each of the national parks. Ideally, there would be good cycling and walking links from these places.
How do we get people out of their cars and into the national parks?
I think ultimately it's going to be a combination of making more alternatives to the car available, but also probably having to introduce some form of restriction on car use. So that could possibly be something like road pricing, certainly thinking about the way in which parking policy and management is used to try and deter people from visiting certain areas.
But is there not a danger there that you want to increase access to parks? And if you introduce a road toll, going to put people off from coming to the national parks?
Well, I think it would need to be done very carefully and clearly done in conjunction with making sure that, good alternatives are available. But I think it's getting to the point where something has to be done in certain places, because there are some places where on a sunny bank holiday weekend, the levels of car use are such that they actually detract from the thing that people have gone to see in the first place, and they are damaging the environment. People are parking inappropriately. And so there is a real need to do something if we're going to say that, you know, we want more people to visit the national parks, but we still want to keep the national parks as places that are protected for their environmental value as well.
Pammy Johal runs a training organisation based in the Scottish Highlands, which provides opportunities in national parks for minority and marginalised communities. She believes that their model of engaging with these groups is helping to improve the numbers actually using the two national parks in Scotland.
We basically work with between 10 and 12 people from black and minority ethnic groups per year to train them as community ambassadors, environmental ambassadors. Now, they, in turn, then take their groups out to the national parks. They understand their community more than anybody else. They can therefore, with that understanding, design environmental projects that are appropriate for that community.
So it's getting better, but is it from a very, very low base? I mean, my observation when I go to a national park is I very rarely see a black or brown face.
Yes, I agree with you. There's still very low numbers. However, things are improving. There are definitely inroads in Scotland, and a really positive inroads that both national parks are doing. And that is a direct result of partnership working and genuine intention. We've got to remember, the national parks are a public service, and that public service needs to be accessible to all communities. We introduce people that wouldn't normally go out into the mountains or into nature. They, once they've experienced the wow factor, they want to learn about that environment and they want to understand it. The more they understand it and learn about it, the more they want to do something about protecting it. So therefore, on a national level, this is really important. And why shouldn't everybody in Britain have the opportunity to have that wow moment?
You're listening to Costing the Earth. Today I'm on the road in search of ideas to improve our national parks so they work better for the public and for the wildlife. So I've come from the Cairngorms and the Highlands to the home counties, which is the South Downs National Park, squeezed, if you like, between outer London and the Channel. And it's a very, very different landscape. It's farmed, but it's farmed much more intensively than up in the Cairngorms and is relatively lowland, a more intensively food-producing landscape. But how do you balance that with the needs of a national park? And with Dominic Gardner, who's from one of the largest of the six South Downs farm clusters, the Arran to Ader Farmers Group.
A farming cluster is a group of farmers that have decided to get together and work together to try and create a better landscape and a better environment for everybody. We actually extend to about 25,000 acres now. It's farmers working together on a landscape scale because wildlife doesn't know boundaries. In a cluster group, it's totally bottom up. So the farmers are making the decisions. It's not government telling us what to do, and there's nobody knows their farm and the wildlife on it better than the people that are there 365 days a year.
Can you give me an example of something you might have put in to join wildlife up to increase that connectivity?
Well, we're joining up with hedgerows, and we're in an area up here which is very good for the Duke of Burgundy butterfly. And we've got one of the best colonies in southern England to the north of us. And we're trying to get that to extend out down to the south. So what we're doing is we're using different forms of scrubland and managing that scrub and that grassland to create that.
Might it mean farming less? Could we see, you know, fewer fields like this with arable crops in?
I think we potentially will see less fields, because what we're going to do is, as we move out of having a subsidy that's paid directly to farmers, what it's actually done is meant sometimes crops are grown that aren't actually financially viable. And part of farming smarter is identifying those crops that make a true profit. And would we carry on growing those ones that don't make a true profit? They have an environmental impact. So could we use that land better for the environment?
Does leaving the European Union and being paid more for public goods, as it's called, very much an emphasis in the spin we're getting off the new agriculture plan, that it should be about the environment as much, if not more, than food production, does that give an opportunity for this landscape?
Yes, it does undoubtedly give an opportunity. But I think what we need to do is we need to find a system that will deliver that effectively and cost effectively. Again, they need to be profitable to be environmentally friendly.
And for places like this here in a national park, do you think it really could work with the direction of travel here in a park?
I think we're already engaged in that travel with park. I think the relationship between the national park and farmers in this area is pretty strong. I feel we're actually ahead of the game in the South Downs. Most of the Downs is now covered by cluster groups. And all these groups working together to create a better environment for their land. But it's going to be a compromise. What we've got to realise is, for the countryside, this is our moment. We all need to work together to develop a system that's going to work, where farmers can be employed and society can enjoy the countryside, and we're protecting it for our future generations.
Amongst many of the actual duties that are put on national parks are two that can seem like the immovable object and the unstoppable force. That is the necessity of protecting the landscape and providing homes. And that's felt nowhere more keenly than here in the South Downs National Park. And I'm in a housing estate that's being built on the edge of Petersfield. And the key to reconciling those two forces here and across much of the country is what's known as a neighbourhood plan. It's, well, does it work? Has it worked here? I'm joined by Chris Patterson, who's Communities Lead for the South Downs National Park Authority.
So we're here in Causeway Park. This is the largest housing allocation site within the Petersfield Neighbourhood Plan. And this is a classic example of a community really getting behind their own plan and identifying where those houses should go and providing houses for people to live locally.
And affordable homes?
We've got 200 new homes coming on this site. 40% of them will be affordable.
How does a neighbourhood plan, or this neighbourhood plan in particular, work?
It is a document prepared by local people, and it contains a lot of policies that will control and affect how development comes forward. So it's really a plan to determine where houses go, what local green spaces are protected. So essentially, the way it works, so in the Localism Act back in 2011, government decided that if they give people more power and the ability to influence the way their towns and communities grow, they'll be more inclined to take development and allow their places to grow. The National Park Authority will determine what they feel is an appropriate level of housing and for an appropriate level of growth for a particular community. And here in Petersfield, we identified that as being a minimum of 700 new homes would be required over the plan period.
Well, I want to hear a little bit more about those development pressures and also some of the arguments surrounding wildlife. And so I'm with someone who can answer those, not just for the South Downs, but a little bit for the rest of England as well. That's Margaret Parran, who's joined me next to a pond in Petersfield here. And she's chair of the South Downs National Park Authority, as well as chair of National Parks England. We were just hearing how here in Petersfield there is housing pressure, but they feel they've got it right with the neighbourhood plan. But that's kind of the exception to the rule in national parks, isn't it? There isn't sufficient housing being provided.
It's always a big balancing act between ensuring that you're providing the housing that local people need and also maintaining the landscape, the wildlife for which the designation took place. We cannot meet the need for housing without damaging the national park. And that is why the national planning framework makes clear that we don't have to meet our objectively assessed need.
In the absolute final analysis, protect the landscape comes first, does it?
Our first and foremost reason for existence is to conserve and enhance the landscape. That's in the statute.
How satisfied are you about how national parks are doing on wildlife?
Well, we're doing as well as we can given the constraints within which we work.
Would you like to have those constraints lifted so you could do better?
We would certainly like to have those constraints lifted. What we are looking for in a post-Brexit world is a more flexible approach to how agro-environment schemes are put together.
You may not agree with some of the more strident criticisms of the wildlife and national park, describing them as deserts and saying they should be downgraded, but do you kind of sympathise with where they're coming from, that they could be done so much better?
I think some of the criticism is about individual places, the nationally protected areas in national parks of wildlife. But we're looking at this at a landscape scale. What we're trying to do is to reconnect the areas which are OACs, perhaps, not only in national parks but outside the national parks, and reconnect them by putting in wildlife corridors. That's what we're about, and that perhaps doesn't come through, and that's perhaps why the criticisms are sometimes launched against us.
Should the national park authorities have more powers within the national parks?
Well, the first and foremost lever, as I said, is about getting a agro-environmental scheme geared to national park purposes. We don't want to see the purposes of the national park change from the 1949 original act. They've stood the test of time, and they're still standing the test of time. But we do think there are perhaps some tweaks that could be made to the way in which other bodies relate to national parks, to perhaps ensure that they have to further national park purposes as well as just acknowledging they exist.
I wanted to put some of those points that we heard to the author of the upcoming National Parks in England review, Julian Glover.
I think this is a huge opportunity for national parks, and they need to come forward and talk about their ambitions and what they're going to do on this. I don't think any central government agency could dictate every element of how anybody is going to run a landscape in their area. But I think one of the things that needs to happen is to look at the whole of the area, not to do what has often happened today and national parks have had to cope with, because of course they haven't had a direct role in shaping any of the farming policies in their area. One of the things that hasn't happened is to look at the whole of the landscape, to say, what do we think this is like today in terms of biodiversity? What could it be like? Where are the weaknesses? Where are the strengths? Where might we see more forest cover? Where might we see better biodiversity? Professor John Lawton produced a very important report a few years ago which called for our approach to nature in and outside national parks to be bigger, better, more joined up. And effectively, that's what we need to do. And national parks are well placed to be among the bodies that do that. I'm not saying they're the only ones that can do it, and nor should they be doing it without the support of other people. But they're well placed because we've dictated them onto maps many years ago. We care about them. We know where they are. We've declared them to be special. They should be at the centre of trying to be part of this sort of nature network that really can exist if we manage to plan it properly.
Subscribe to Costing the Earth on BBC Sounds, and then you won't miss the next episode.